Harry dropped out of the air. He sprawled on his stomach in the remains, which smelled strongly of nothing more than rich, damp earth. In front of his face was a hand formed entirely of dirt, similar to but larger than the one they had seen in Ricky's bungalow. Two fingers twitched with a residue of supernatural energy and seemed to reach toward his nose. He slammed one fist into that disembodied monstrosity, pulverizing it. Screaming dancers stumbled into him and collapsed across his back and legs. He scrambled out from under the falling bodies onto his feet. An angry boy in a Batman t-shirt rushed forward and took a swing at him. Harry ducked, threw a right into the kid's stomach, planted a left uppercut under his chin, stepped over him when he fell, and looked around for Connie. She was nearby, dropping a tough-looking teenage girl with a karate kick, and then swiveling on one foot to drive her elbow into the solar plexus of a muscle-bound youth who looked surprised as he went down. He obviously thought he was going to polish his shoes with her and throw her away. If she felt as rotten as Harry did, she might not be able to hold her own. His joints still ached with the cold that had seeped into them during the pause, and he felt tired as if he had carried a great weight on a journey of many miles. Joining up with her, screaming to be heard above the music and other noise, Harry said, "We're too old for this crap. Come on, let's get out of here." For the most part, on every side, the dancing had given way to fighting, or at least to vigorous pushing and shoving, thanks to the tricks that Tick-Tock had played earlier on his way through the paused crowd. However, not all of the partiers seemed to understand that the rave had devolved into a dangerous brawl, because some of the pushers and shovers were laughing as if they believed they had merely been caught up in a boisterous, relatively good-natured slam dance. Harry and Connie were too far from the front of the building to make it out that way before an understanding of the true nature of the situation swept the crowd. Though there was nothing as immediately threatening as a fire, the tendency of a panicked crowd would be to react to the violence as if flames had been seen. Some of them would even believe they had seen fire. Harry grabbed Connie's hand to keep them from being separated in the turmoil and led her toward the nearer rear wall where he was sure there would have to be other doors. In that chaotic atmosphere, it was easy to understand why the revelers would confuse real violence for make-believe, even if they hadn't been on drugs. Spotlights swung back and forth and looped across the metal ceiling. Intensely colored laser beams slashed complex patterns across the room. Strobes flashed. Phantasmagoric shadows leaped, twisted, twirled through the energetic crowd. Young faces were strange and mysterious behind ever-changing carnival masks of reflected light. Psychedelic film images pulsed and writhed over two big walls. The disc jockey pumped up the volume on the manic music, and the crowd noise alone was loud enough to be disorienting. The senses were overloaded and apt to mistake a glimpse of violent confrontation for an exhibition of high good spirits or something even more benign. Far behind Harry, a scream rose unlike any of the others, so shrill and hysterical that it pierced the background roar and called attention to itself even in that cacophony. No more than a minute had passed since the pause had ended, if that long. Harry figured that the new screamer was either the black-haired girl coming out of shock and discovering that her shoulder ended in a gory stump, or the person who had suddenly found himself confronted by the grisly detached arm. Even if that heart-stopping wail didn't draw attention, the crowd would not party on in ignorance much longer. There was nothing like a punch in the face to dislodge fantasy and snap reality into place. When the change in the mood penetrated to a majority of the ravers, the rush to the exits would be potentially deadly, even though there was no fire. A sense of duty and a policeman's conscience encouraged Harry to turn back, find the girl who had lost an arm, and try to administer first aid. But he knew that he would probably not be able to find her in that churning throng, and that he wouldn't have a chance to help even if he did manage to locate her. Not in that growing human maelstrom, which already seemed to have reached the equivalent of hurricane force. Holding tight to Connie's hand, Harry pushed out of the dancers and through the now clamorous onlookers with their bottles of beer and balloons of nitrous oxide, all the way to the back wall of the warehouse, which was deep under the loft, beyond the reach of the party lights. Darkest place in the building. He looked left, right, couldn't see a door. That wasn't surprising, considering a rave was essentially an illegal drug party staged in a deserted warehouse, not a chaperoned prom in a hotel ballroom where there would be well-lit red exit signs. But Jesus, it would be so pointless and stupid to survive the paws and the golems only to be trampled to death by hundreds of doped-up kids frantically trying to squeeze through a doorway all at once. Harry decided to go right, for no better reason than he had to go one way or the other. Unconscious kids were lying on the floor, recovering from long hits of laughing gas. Harry tried not to step on anyone, but the light under the loft was so poor that he didn't see some of those in darker clothes until he'd stumbled over them. A door. He almost passed by without spotting it. In the warehouse behind him, the music continued to thump as ever, but a sudden change occurred in the quality of the crowd noise. It became a less celebratory roar, darkened into an uglier rumble, shot through with panicky shrieks. Connie was gripping Harry's hand so tightly she was grinding his knuckles together. In the gloom, Harry pushed against the door, pushed with his shoulders, wouldn't budge. No, must be an outside door. Pull inward, but that didn't work either. The crowd broke toward the outer walls. A wave of screaming swelled, and Harry could actually feel the heat and terror of the oncoming mob that was surging even toward the back wall. They were probably too disoriented to remember where the main entrances were. He fumbled for the door handle, knob, push bar, whatever, and prayed it wasn't locked. He found a vertical handle with a thumb latch, pressed down, felt something click. The first of the escaping crowd rammed into them from behind. Connie cried out. Harry shoved back at them, trying to keep them out of the way so he could pull the door open. Please, God, don't let it be a restroom or closet, or we'll be crushed, smothered. Kept his thumb downward on the latch. The door popped as he pulled it inward, shouting at the crowd behind him to wait, wait, for God's sake. And then the door was torn out of his grasp and slammed all the way open, and he and Connie were carried outside into the cool night air by the desperate tide of people behind them. More than a dozen ravers were in a parking area, gathered around the back of a white Ford van. The van was draped with two sets of white and red Christmas tree lights, which operated off its battery and provided the only illumination in the deep night between the back of the building and the scrub-covered canyon wall. One long-haired man was filling balloons from a pressure tank of nitrous oxide that was strapped to a hand truck behind the van, and a totally bald guy was collecting $5 bills. All of them, both merchants and customers, looked up in amazement as screaming and shouting people erupted through the back door of the warehouse. Harry and Connie separated, bypassing everyone behind the van. She went around to the passenger side door, and Harry went to the driver's side. He jerked open the door and started to climb in behind the steering wheel. The guy with the shaved head grabbed his arm, stopped him, and pulled him out.
Hey, man, what do you think you're doing?
As he was being dragged backward out of the van, Harry reached under his coat and drew his revolver. Turning, he jammed the muzzle against his adversary's lips.
You want me to blow your teeth out the back of your head?
The bald man's eyes went wide, and he backed up fast, raising both hands to show he was harmless.
No, hey, no, man. Cool it. Take the van. She's yours. Have fun. Enjoy.
Distasteful as Connie's methods might be, Harry had to admit there was a certain time-saving efficiency when you handled problems her way. He climbed behind the steering wheel again, pulled the door shut, and holstered his revolver. Connie was already in the passenger seat. The keys were in the ignition, and the engine was running to keep the battery charged up for the Christmas lights. Christmas lights, for God's sake. Festive bunch, these N.O. dealers. He released the handbrake, switched on the headlights, threw the van in gear, and tramped hard on the accelerator. For a moment, the tires spun and smoked, squealing like angry pigs on the blacktop, and all the ravers scattered. Then the rubber bit in, the van shot toward the back corner of the warehouse, and Harry hammered the horn to keep people out of his way.
The road out here's going to jam tight in 2 minutes, Connie said, bracing herself against the dashboard as they rounded the corner of the warehouse, not quite on two wheels.
Yeah, he said. Everyone trying to get away before the cops show up.
Cops are such party poopers.
Such numbnuts.
Never any fun. Prudes.
They rocketed down the wide driveway alongside the warehouse, where there was no exit door and therefore no panicked people to worry about. The van handled well, real power and a good suspension. He supposed it had been modified for quick escapes when the police showed up. Out in front of the warehouse, the situation was different, and he had to use the brake and the horn, weaving wildly to avoid fleeing partiers. More people had escaped the building more quickly than he had imagined possible.
Promoters were smart enough to roll up one of the big truck doors to let people out,
Connie said, turning in her seat to look out the side window as they went past the place.
Surprised it even works, Harry said. God knows how long the place has stood empty.
With the pressure inside so quickly relieved, the death toll, if there was one, would be substantially smaller. Hanging a hard left into the street, Harry clipped a parked car with the rear bumper of the van but kept going, blowing the horn at the few ravers who had made it that far and were running down the middle of the street like terrified people in one of those Godzilla movies fleeing from the giant thunder lizard. Connie said,
"You pulled your gun on that bald guy."
"Yeah."
"I hear you tell him you'd blow his head off?"
"Something like that."
"Didn't show him your badge?"
"Figured he'd have respect for a gun. None at all for a badge." She said,
"I could get to like you, Harry Lyon."
"No future in it, unless we get past dawn." In seconds, they were past all of the partiers who had left the warehouse on foot, and Harry tramped the accelerator all the way to the floor. They shot by the nursery, body shops, and recreational vehicle storage lot that they had passed on the way in, and were soon beyond the partiers' parked cars. He wanted to be long gone from the area when the Laguna Beach police arrived, which they would, and soon. Being caught in the aftermath of the rave debacle would tie them up too long, maybe just long enough so they would lose their one and only chance of getting the drop on Tick-Tock.
"Where are you going?"
Connie asked. "The greenhouse."
"Yeah, maybe Sammy's still there."
"Sammy?"
"The bum. That was his name."
"Oh, yeah. And the talking dog."
"Talking dog,"
she said. "Well, maybe he doesn't talk, but he's got something to tell us we need to know. That's for damn sure. And maybe he does talk. What the hell? Who knows anymore? It's a crazy world, a crazy damn night. There are talking animals in fairy tales. Why not a talking dog in Laguna Beach?" Harry realized he was babbling, but he was driving so fast and recklessly that he didn't want to take his eyes off the road, even to glance at Connie and see if she was giving him a skeptical look. She didn't sound worried about his sanity when she said,
"What's the plan?"
"I think we've got a narrow window of opportunity."
"Because he has to rest now and then, like he told you on the car radio."
"Yeah, especially after something like this. So far, there's always been an hour or more between his appearances."
"Manifestations."
"Whatever." After a few turns, they were back in residential neighborhoods, working through Laguna toward the Pacific Coast Highway. A police car and an ambulance, emergency beacons flashing, shot past them on a cross street, almost certainly answering a call to the warehouse.
"Fast response," Connie said.
"Someone with a car phone must have dialed 911. Maybe help would arrive in time to save the girl who had lost an arm. Maybe the arm could even be saved, sewn back on. Yeah, and maybe Mother Goose was real. Harry had been buoyant because they had escaped the pause and the rave, but his adrenaline high faded swiftly as he recalled, too vividly, how savagely the golem had torn off the young woman's slender arm. Despair crept back in at the edges of his thoughts.
"If there's a window of opportunity while he rests or even sleeps," Connie said, "how can we possibly find him fast enough?"
"Not with one of Nancy Kwan's portraits, that's for sure. No time for that approach anymore." She said,
"I think next time he manifests, he'll kill us. No more playing around."
"I think so, too."
"Or at least kill me. Then you the time after that."
"By dawn. That's one promise our little boy will keep." They were both silent for a moment, somber.
"So where does that leave us?" she asked.
"Maybe the bum in the front of the greenhouse.
Sammy, maybe he knows something that will help us. Or if not, then, hell, I don't know.
It looks hopeless, doesn't it?"
"No," she said sharply. "Nothing's hopeless. Where there's life, there's hope. Where there's hope, it's always worth trying, worth going on."
He wheeled around another corner from one street full of dark houses to another, straightened out the van, let up on the accelerator a little, and looked at her in astonishment.
"Nothing's hopeless. What's happened to you?"
She shook her head.
"I don't know. It's still happening."
Although they had spent at least half of the hour-long pause on the run before they had wound up in the warehouse at the end of the canyon, they didn't need nearly as long to get back to where they had started from. According to Connie's wristwatch, they had reached the coast highway less than 5 minutes after commandeering the nitrous oxide dealer's wheels, partly because they took a more direct return route, and partly because Harry drove fast enough to scare even her. In fact, when they slid to a stop in front of the greenhouse, with some still unbroken Christmas lights clinking noisily along the sides of the van, the time was just 35 seconds past 1:37 in the morning. That was little more than 8 minutes since the pause had both begun and ended at 1:29, which meant they had taken about 3 minutes to fight their way out of the crowded warehouse and seize their transportation at gunpoint, though it sure had seemed a lot longer. The tow truck and the Volvo, which had been frozen in the southbound lane, were gone. When time had started up again, their drivers had continued on with no realization that anything unusual had happened. Other traffic was moving north and south. Connie was relieved to see Sammy standing on the sidewalk in front of the greenhouse. He was gesticulating wildly, arguing with the permed host in the Armani suit and hand-painted silk tie. One of the waiters was standing in the doorway, apparently prepared to help the boss if the confrontation got physical. When Connie and Harry got out of the van, the host saw them and turned away from Sammy.
"You!"
he said.
"My God, it's you!"
He came toward them purposefully, almost angrily, as if they had left without paying their check. Bar patrons and other employees were at the windows watching. Connie recognized some of them as people who had been watching her and Harry and Sammy and the dog, and who had been frozen there staring fixedly after the pause hit. They were no longer as rigid as stone, but they were still watching with fascination.
"What's going on here?"
the host asked as he approached, an edge of hysteria in his voice.
"How did that happen? Where did you go? What is this van?"
Connie had to remind herself that the man had seen them vanish in what seemed to him a split second. The dog yelped and nipped the air and plunged for the shrubbery, alerting them that something was happening, which had spooked Sammy into sprinting for the alley. But Connie and Harry had remained on the sidewalk in full view of the people at the restaurant windows. The pause had hit, they had been forced to run for their lives, then the pause had ended without them where they originally had been on the sidewalk, and to onlookers it seemed as if two people had vanished into thin air, only to turn up 8 minutes later in a white van decorated with strings of red and green Christmas lights. The host's exasperation and curiosity were understandable. If their window of opportunity for finding and dealing with Tick-Tock had not been so small, if the ticking seconds had not been leading them inexorably closer to sudden death, the uproar in front of the restaurant might even have been funny. Hell, it was funny, but that didn't mean she and Harry could take the time to laugh at it. Maybe later, if they lived.
"What is this? What happened here? What's going on?"
the host demanded.
"I can't make heads or tails out of what your raving lunatic over there is telling me."
By raving lunatic, he meant Sammy. "He's not our raving lunatic," Harry said.
"Yes, he is," Connie reminded Harry. "And you better go talk to him. I'll handle this."
She was half afraid that Harry, as painfully aware of their time limit as she was, might pull his revolver on the host and threaten to blow his teeth out the back of his head if he didn't shut up and get inside. As much as she approved of Harry taking a more aggressive approach to certain problems, there was a proper time and place for aggression, and this was not it. Harry went off to talk with Sammy. Connie put one arm around the host's shoulders and escorted him up the walkway to the door of his restaurant, speaking in a soft but authoritative voice, informing him that she and Detective Lyon were in the middle of important and urgent police business, and sincerely assuring him that she would return to explain everything, even what might seem to him inexplicable, just as soon as the ongoing situation is resolved. Considering that it was traditionally Harry's job to calm and placate people, her job to upset them, she had a lot of success with the restaurateur. She had no intention of ever returning to explain anything whatsoever to him, and she had no idea how he thought she could explain people vanishing into thin air. But he calmed down, and she persuaded him to go inside his restaurant with the bodyguard waiter who was standing in the doorway. She checked the shrubbery but confirmed what she already knew. The dog was not hiding there anymore. He was gone. She joined Harry and Sammy on the sidewalk in time to hear the hobo say,
"How should I know where he lives? He's an alien. He's a long way from his planet. He must have a spaceship hidden around here somewhere."
More patiently than Connie expected, Harry said, "Forget that stuff. He's no alien. He..." A dog barked, startling them. Connie spun around and saw the flop-eared mutt. He was uphill, just turning the corner at the south end of the block. Following him were a woman and a boy of about 5. As soon as the dog saw that he had gotten their attention, he snatched hold of one cuff of the boy's jeans and with his teeth impatiently pulled him along. After a couple of steps, he let go, ran toward Connie, stopped halfway between his people and hers, barked at her, barked at the woman and boy, barked at Connie again, then just sat there looking left and right and left again, as if to say, "Well, haven't I done enough?" The woman and boy appeared to be curious, but frightened. The mother was attractive in a way, and the child was cute, neat, and cleanly dressed, but they both had the wary and haunted look of people who knew the streets too well. Connie approached them slowly with a smile. When she passed the dog, he got off his butt and padded along at her side, panting and grinning. There was a quality of mystery and awe about the moment, and Connie knew that whatever connection they were about to make was going to mean life or death to her and Harry, maybe to all of them. She had no idea what she was going to say to them until she was close enough to speak.
"Have you also had a strange experience lately?"
The woman blinked at her in surprise.
"Strange experience? Oh, yes. Oh, my. Yes."
Part 3. A Scary Little Cottage in the Woods. Far away in China, the people sometimes say, life is often bitter and all too seldom gay. Bitter as dragon tears, great cascades of sorrow flood down all the years, drowning our tomorrows. Far away in China, the people also say, life is sometimes joyous, if all too often gray. Although life is seasoned with bitter dragon tears, seasoning is just a spice within our brew of years. Bad times are only rice, tears are one more flavor that gives us sustenance, something we can savor. The Book of Counted Sorrows.
Now they know. He is a good dog. Good dog. Good. They are all together now. The woman and the boy. The stinky man. The not-so-stinky man. And the woman without a boy. All of them smelling of the touch of the thing that will kill you, which is why he knew they had to be together. They know it, too. They know why they are together. They stand in front of the people food place, talking to each other, talking fast, all excited, sometimes all talking at once, while the woman and the boy and the not-so-stinky man are always sure to keep the stinky man upwind from them. They keep stooping down to pet him and scratch behind his ears and tell him he's a good dog, good, and they say other nice things about him that he can't really understand. This is the best. It is so good to be petted and scratched and liked by people who will, he is pretty sure, not set his fur on fire, and by people who do not have any cat smell on them. None. Once, long after the little girl who called him Prince, there were some people who took him into their place and fed him and were nice to him, called him Max, but they had a cat, big cat, mean. The cat was called Fluffy. Max was nice to Fluffy. Max never once chased Fluffy. In those days, Max never chased cats. Well, hardly ever. Some cats he liked, but Fluffy did not like Max and did not want Max in the people place, so sometimes Fluffy stole Max's food, and other times Fluffy peed in Max's water bowl. During the day, when the nice people were gone from their place to some other place, Max and Fluffy were left alone, and Fluffy would screech all crazy and spitting and scare Max and chase him around the place or jump off high things onto Max. Big cat, screeching, spitting, crazy. So Max understood that it was Fluffy's place, not Max's and Fluffy's place, just Fluffy's. So he went away from the nice people, and he was just fella again. Ever since, he worries that when he finds nice people who want to take him into their place and feed him forever, they will have cat smell on him, and when he goes to their place with them and walks in the door with them, there will be Fluffy, big, mean, crazy. So now it is nice that none of these people has any cat smell, because if one of them wants to be a family with him, he will be safe, and he won't have to worry about pee in his water bowl. After a while, they're so excited talking to each other that they aren't petting him so much and saying how good he is, so he gets bored. Yawned. Lies down. Might sleep. He is tired. Busy day being a good dog. But then he sees the people in the food place looking out the windows of the food place. Interesting. At the windows, looking out, looking at him. Maybe they think he's cute. Maybe they want to give him food. Why wouldn't they want to give him food? So he gets up and pads to the food place. Head high, prance a little, wag a tail. They like that. At the door, he waits. Nobody opens it. He puts one paw on it. Waits. Nobody. He scratches. Nobody. He goes out where the people at the window can see him. He wags his tail. He tilts his head, pricks up one ear. They see him. He knows they see him. He goes to the door again. Waits. 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 Scratches. Nobody. Maybe they don't know he wants food. Or maybe they're scared of him. Think he's a bad dog. He doesn't look like a bad dog. How could they be scared? Don't they know when to be scared, when not? He would never jump off high places on top of them or pee in their water bowls. Stupid people. Stupid. Finally, he decides he's not going to get any food, so he goes back to the nice people he brought together. On his way, he keeps his head up, prances, wags his tail, just to show the people at the window what they're missing. When he gets back to the women and the boy and the stinky man and the not-so-stinky man, something is wrong. He can feel it and smell it. They're scared. This is not new. They have all been scared since he first smelled each of them, but this is a different scared. Worse scared. And they have a little trace of the just-lie-down-and-die smell. Animals get that smell sometimes when they're old, when they're very tired and sick. People not so often. Though he knows a place where people have that smell. He was there earlier in the night with the woman and the boy. Interesting. But bad interesting. He is worried that these nice people have even a little bit of the just-lie-down-and-die smell. What is wrong with them? Not sick. Maybe the stinky man sick a little, but not the rest of them. Not old, either. Their voices are different, too. A little excited, not so much as before. Tired a little, sad a little. Something else, what? Something. What? What? He sniffs around their feet one at a time. Sniffs, 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 sniffs. Even the stinky man. And suddenly he knows what's wrong with them. And he can't believe it, can't. He's amazed, amazed. He backs away, looks at them, amazed. All of them have the special smell that says, do I chase it or does it chase me? Do I run or do I fight? Am I hungry enough to dig something out of its hole and eat it, or should I wait and see if people will give me something good? It is the smell of not knowing what to do, which is sometimes a different kind of fear smell. Like now, they're afraid of the thing that will kill you, but they are also afraid because they don't know what to do next. He is amazed because he knows what to do next, and he is not even a people, but sometimes they can be so slow, people. All right, he will show them what to do next. He barks, and of course they all look at him because he's not a dog that barks much. He barks again, then runs past them downhill, runs, runs, then stops and looks back and barks again. They stare at him. He is amazed. He runs back to them, barks, turns, runs downhill again, runs, runs, stops, looks back, barks again. They're talking, looking at him and talking, like maybe they get it. So he runs a little farther, turns, looks back, barks. They're excited. They get it. Amazing. They did not know how far the dog was going to lead them, and they were agreed that the five of them would be too conspicuous on foot as a group at almost 2 o'clock in the morning. They decided to see if Woofer would be as eager to run ahead and lead the van as he was to lead them on foot, because in the vehicle they would be considerably less of a spectacle. Janet helped Detective Gulliver and Detective Lyon quickly take the Christmas tree lights off the van. They were attached with metal clips in some places and with pieces of masking tape in others. It seemed doubtful that the dog was going to lead them directly to the person they were calling Tick-Tock. Just in case, however, it made a lot of sense not to draw attention to themselves with strings of red and green lights. While they worked, Sammy Shamro followed them around the ford, telling them, not for the first time, that he had been a fool and a fallen man, but that he was going to turn over a new leaf after this. It seemed important to him that they believe he was sincere in making a commitment to a new life, as if he needed other people to believe it before he would be convinced himself.
"I never really thought I had anything the world really needed," Sammy said. "Thought I was pretty much worthless, just a hype artist, a smooth talker, empty inside, but now here I am, saving the world from an alien. Okay, not an alien exactly, and not saving the world all by myself, but helping to save it, damn sure enough."
Janet was still astonished by what Woofer had done. No one was quite sure how he knew that the five of them were living under the same bizarre threat, or that it would be useful for them to be brought together. Everyone knew that animal senses were in some respects weaker than those of human beings, but in many respects stronger, and that beyond the usual five senses they might have others that were difficult to understand. But after this, she would never look at another dog, or any animal for that matter, in quite the same way that she had regarded them before. Taking the dog into their lives and feeding him when she could least afford it had turned out to be perhaps the smartest thing she had ever done. She and the two detectives finished removing the lights, rolled them up, and put them in the back of the van.
"I've quit drinking for good," Sammy said, following them to the rear door. "Can you believe it? But it's true. No more, not one drop, nada."
Woofer was sitting on the sidewalk with Danny in the fall of light under a street lamp, watching them, waiting patiently. Initially, when she had learned that Ms. Gulliver and Mr. Lyon were police detectives, Janet had almost grabbed Joey and run. After all, she had left a dead husband, killed by her own hand, moldering under desert sands in Arizona, and she had no way of knowing if the hateful man was still where she had buried him. If Vince's body had been found, she might be wanted for questioning. There might even be a warrant for her arrest. More to the point, no authority figure in her life had been a friend to her, with the possible exception of Mr. Ishigura at Pacific View Care Home. She thought of them as a different breed, people with whom she had nothing in common. But Ms. Gulliver and Mr. Lyon seemed reliable and kind and well-meaning. She did not think they were the type of people who would let Danny be taken away from her, though she had no intention of telling them she'd killed Vince. And Janet certainly did have things in common with them, not least of all the will to live and the desire to get tick-tock before he got them. She had decided to trust the detectives, largely because she had no choice. They were all in this together. But she also decided to trust them because the dog trusted them. "It's 5 minutes till 2, Detective Lyon said, checking his wristwatch. "Let's get moving, for God's sake." Janet called Danny to her, and he got into the back of the van with her and Sammy Shamro, who pulled the rear door shut after them. Detective Lyon climbed into the driver's seat, started the engine, and switched on the headlights. The rear of the van was open to the front compartment. Janet, Danny, and Sammy crowded forward to look over the front seat and through the windshield. Serpentine tendrils of thin fog were beginning to slither across the coast highway from the ocean. The headlights of an oncoming car, the only other traffic in sight, caught the lazily drifting mist at just the right angle and created a horizontal ribbon of rainbow-like colors that began at the right-hand curb and ended at the left-hand curb. The car drove through the colors, carrying them off into the night. Detective Gulliver was still standing out on the sidewalk with Woofer. Detective Lyon released the handbrake and put the van in gear. Raising his voice slightly, he said, "Okay, we're ready." On the sidewalk, Detective Gulliver could hear him because the van's side window was open. She talked to the dog, made a shooing motion with her hands, and the dog studied her quizzically. Realizing that they were asking him to lead them where he had wanted to lead them just a couple of minutes ago, Woofer took off downhill, north along the sidewalk. He ran about one-third of a block, stopped, and looked back to see if Detective Gulliver was following. He seemed pleased to discover that she was staying with him. He wagged his tail. Detective Lyon took his foot off the brake and let the van drift downhill close behind Detective Gulliver, keeping pace with her, so the dog would get the idea that the vehicle was also following him. Though the van was not moving fast, Janet gripped the seat behind Detective Lyon's head to steady herself, and Sammy clutched the headrest behind the empty passenger seat. With one hand, Danny held fast to Janet's belt and stood on his tiptoes trying to see what was happening outside. When Detective Gulliver had almost caught up with Woofer, the dog took off again, sprinted to the end of the block, and stopped at the intersection to look back. He watched the woman approaching him, then studied the van for a moment, then the woman, then the van. He was a smart dog. He would get it. "Wish he'd just talk to us and tell us what we need to know," Detective Lyon said.
"Who?"
Sammy asked.
"The dog."
After Detective Gulliver followed Woofer across the intersection and halfway along the next block, she stopped and let Detective Lyon catch up to her. She waited until Woofer was looking at her, then opened the passenger door and got into the van. The dog sat down and stared at them. Detective Lyon let the van drift forward a little. The dog pricked up its ears lopsidedly. The van drifted. The dog got up and trotted farther north. He stopped, looked back to be sure the van was still coming, then trotted farther.
"Good dog," Detective Gulliver said.
"Very good dog," Detective Lyon said.
Danny said proudly,
"He's the best dog there is."
"I'll second that,"
said Sammy Shamro, and rubbed one hand on the boy's head. Turning his face into Janet's side, Danny said,
"Mama, the man really stinks."
"Danny,"
Janet said, appalled.
It's okay, Sammy said. He was inspired to launch into another of his earnest but rambling assurances of repentance. It's true. I stink. I'm a mess. Been a mess for a long time, but that's over now. You know one reason I was a mess? Because I thought I knew everything, thought I understood exactly what life was about, that it was meaningless, that there was no mystery to it. It's just biology. But after this, after tonight, I have a different view on things. I don't know everything after all. It's true. Hell, I don't know diddly squat. There's plenty of mystery in life, something more than biology. For sure. And if there's something more, who needs wine or cocaine or anything? Nope, nothing. Not a drop. Nada.
One block later, the dog turned right, heading east along a steeply rising street. Detective Lyon turned the corner after Woofer and then glanced at his wristwatch. 2 o'clock. Damn, time's just going too fast. Outside, Woofer rarely turned his head to glance at them anymore. He was confident that they would stay with him. The sidewalk along which he padded was littered with bristly red blooms from the large bottlebrush trees that lined the entire block. Woofer sniffed at them as he proceeded east, and they made him sneeze a couple of times. Suddenly, Janet thought she knew where the dog was taking them.
Mr. Ishiguro's nursing home, she said.
Detective Gulliver turned in the front seat to look at her.
You know where he's going?
We were there for dinner, in the kitchen, and then... My God! The poor blind woman with no eyes.
Pacific View Care Home was in the next block. The dog climbed the steps and sat at the front door. After visiting hours, no receptionist was on duty. Harry could look through the glass in the top of the door and see the dimly lit and totally deserted public lounge. When he rang the bell, a woman's voice responded through the intercom. He identified himself as a police officer on urgent business, and she sounded concerned and eager to cooperate. He checked his wristwatch 3 times before she appeared in the lounge. She didn't take an extraordinarily long time. He was just remembering Ricky Estefan and the girl who had lost an arm at the rave, and each second blinked off by the red indicator light on his watch was part of the countdown to his own execution. The nurse, who identified herself as the night supervisor, was a no-nonsense Filipino lady, petite but not in the least fragile, and when she saw him through the portal in the door, she was less sanguine than she had been over the intercom. She would not open up to him. First of all, she didn't believe he was a police officer. He couldn't blame her for being suspicious, considering that after all he had been through during the past 12 or 14 hours, he looked as if he lived in a packing crate. Well, actually, Sammy Shamro lived in a packing crate, and Harry didn't look quite that bad, but he certainly looked like a flophouse dweller with a long-term moral debt to the Salvation Army. She would only open the door the width of the industrial-quality security chain, so heavy it was surely the model used to restrict access to nuclear missile silos. At her demand, he passed through his police ID wallet. Although it included a photograph that was sufficiently unflattering to resemble him in his current battered and filthy condition, she was unconvinced that he was an officer of the law. Wrinkling her nose, the night supervisor said, "What else have you got?" He was sorely tempted to draw his revolver, shove it through the gap, cock the hammer, and threaten to blow her teeth out through the back of her head. But she was in her middle to late 30s, and it was possible that she had grown up under and been toughened by the Marcos regime before emigrating to the U.S., so she might just laugh in his face, stick her finger in the barrel, and tell him to go to hell. Instead, he produced Connie Gulliver, who was for once a more presentable police officer than he was. She grinned through the glass door at the pint-sized Gestapo Florence Nightingale, made nice talk, and passed her own credentials through the gap on demand. You would have thought they were trying to get into the main vault at Fort Knox instead of a pricey private nursing home. He checked his watch. It was 2:03 a.m. Based on the limited experience they'd had with TikTok, Harry guessed that their psychotic Houdini required as little as an hour, but more commonly an hour and a half, of rest between performances, recharging his supernatural batteries in about the same amount of time that a stage magician needed to stuff all the silk scarves and doves and rabbits back up his sleeves to get ready for the late show. If that was the case, then they were safe at least until 2:30 and probably until 3 o'clock. Less than an hour at the outside. Harry was so intently focused on the blinking red light of his watch that he lost track of what Connie said to the nurse. Either she charmed the lady or came up with an incredibly effective threat, because the security chain was removed, the door was opened, their ID wallets were returned to them with smiles, and they were welcomed into Pacific View. When the night supervisor saw Janet and Danny, who had been out of sight on the lower front steps, she had second thoughts. When she saw the dog, she had third thoughts, even though he was wagging his tail and grinning and quite clearly being intentionally cute. When she saw and smelled Sammy, she almost became intractable again. For policemen, as well as for house-to-house salesmen, the supreme difficulty was always getting through the door. Once inside, Harry and Connie were no easier to dislodge than the average vacuum cleaner salesman intent on scattering all manner of sample filth on your carpet to demonstrate the superior suction of his product. When it became clear to the Filipino nurse that resistance to them was going to disturb the home's patients more than would cooperation, she spoke a few musical words in Tagalog, which Harry assumed was a curse on their ancestors and progeny, and led them through the facility to the room of the patient they sought. Not surprisingly, in all of Pacific View's accommodations, there was only one eyeless woman with lids sewn shut over empty sockets. Her name was Jennifer Drachman. Mrs. Drachman's handsome but distant son, they were told in whispered confidence while in transit, paid for 3 shifts of the finest nurses 7 days a week to care for his mentally disoriented mother. She was the only patient in Pacific View provided with such suffocating ministrations on top of the already extravagant care that the facility offered in its minimum package. With those and a number of other loaded words, the night supervisor made it clear, ever so politely, that she didn't care for the son, felt the private nurses were unnecessary and an insult to the staff, and thought the patient was creepy. The private nurse on the graveyard shift was an exotically beautiful black woman named Tanya Delaney. She was not sure of the propriety and wisdom of letting them disturb her patient at such an ungodly hour, even if some of them were police officers, and briefly she threatened to be even more of a barrier to their survival than the night supervisor had been. The gaunt, mealy, bony woman in the bed was a ghastly sight, but Harry could not look away from her. She compelled attention because within the horror of her current condition, there was a tragically faint but undeniable ghost of beauty that had once been, a specter that haunted the ravaged face and body, and by refusing to relinquish entire possession of her, allowed a chilling comparison between what she most likely had been in her youth and what she had become.
"She's been sleeping,"
Tanya Delaney spoke in a whisper as they all did. She stood between them and the bed, making it clear that she took nursing seriously.
"She doesn't sleep peacefully very often, so I wouldn't like to wake her."
Beyond the piled pillows and the patient's face, on a nightstand that also held a cork-bottomed tray with a chrome carafe of ice water, stood a simple black-lacquered picture frame with a photograph of a good-looking young man of about 20. An aquiline nose, thick, dark hair. His pale eyes were gray in the black-and-white photo and were surely gray in reality, the precise shade of slightly tarnished silver. It was the boy in blue jeans and a Tecate t-shirt, the boy licking his lips with a pink tongue at the sight of James Ordegard's blood-soaked victims. Harry remembered the hateful glare in the boy's eyes after he'd been forced back behind the yellow crime scene tape and humiliated in front of the crowd.
"It's him," Harry said softly, wonderingly.
Tanya Delaney followed his gaze.
"Brian, Mrs. Drachman's son."
Turning to meet Connie's eyes, Harry said,
"It's him."
"Doesn't look like the rat man," Sammy said.
He had moved to the corner of the room farthest from the patient, perhaps remembering that the blind supposedly compensated for their loss of sight by developing better hearing and a sharper sense of smell. The dog mewled once, briefly, quietly. Janet Marco pulled her sleepy boy tighter against her side and stared worriedly at the photograph.
"Looks a little like Vince. The hair, the eyes. No wonder I thought Vince was coming back."
Harry wondered who Vince was, decided it wasn't a priority, and said to Connie, "If her son really does pay all of her bills..."
"Oh, yes, it's the son," said Nurse Delaney. "He takes such good care of his mother."
"Then the business office here will have an address for him,"
Connie finished. Harry shook his head. "That night supervisor won't let us look at the records, no way. She'll guard him with her life until we come back with a warrant." Nurse Delaney said,
"I really think you should go before you wake her."
"I'm not asleep,"
said the white scarecrow in the bed. Her permanently shut eyelids didn't even twitch, lay slack as if the muscles in them had atrophied over the years.
and I don't want his photo here. He forces me to keep it.
Harry said, Mrs. Drachman?
Miss. They call me Mrs., but I'm not. I never was.
Her voice was thin, but not frail. Brittle. Cold.
What do you want with him?
Miss Drachman, Harry continued, we're police officers. We need to ask you some questions about your son. If they had the opportunity to learn more about Tick-Tock's address, Harry believed they should seize it. The mother might tell them something that would reveal some vulnerability in her exceptional offspring, even if she had no idea of his true nature. She was silent a moment, chewing on her lip. Her mouth was pinched, her lips so bloodless they were almost gray. Harry looked at his watch. 2:08. The wasted woman raised one arm and hooked her hand, as lean and fierce-looking as a talon, around the bed rail.
Tanya, would you leave us alone?
When the nurse began to voice a mild objection, the patient repeated the request more sharply as a command. As soon as the nurse had gone, closing the door behind her, Jennifer Drachman said,
How many of you are there?
5, Connie said, failing to mention the dog.
You aren't all police officers, and you aren't here just on police business,
Jennifer Drachman said, with perspicacity that might have been a gift she'd been given to compensate for the long years of blindness. Something in her tone of voice, a curious hopefulness, induced Harry to answer her truthfully. No, we're not all cops, and we're not here just as cops.
What has he done to you?
The woman asked. He had done so much that no one could think how to put it into words succinctly. Interpreting the silence correctly, the woman said,
Do you know what he is?
It was an extraordinary question, and revealed that the mother was aware, at least to some degree, of the son's difference. Yes, Harry said, we know.
Everyone thinks he's such a nice boy,
the mother said, her voice tremulous.
They won't listen, the stupid fools. They won't listen. All these years, they won't believe.
We'll listen, Harry said, and we already believe.